Yes, today we will do some exciting physics about resonant cavities, which are some of the most important topics of this chapter. And this will be the last lecture about chapter 8, and then next lecture we'll be talking about radiation, how like antennas work and stuff like that, or an atom as a single atom antenna radiates out photons into the wild. Make a note of the change in office hours for Friday, by the way. It's keep having one-time interferences with my office hours, but we'll try to muddle through this. So what is a resonant cavity? It's just one shape of a resonant cavity. It's not the only possible shape, but what I will focus on is basically having a waveguide with a constant cross section, but now we're going to tack on the end conducting end caps. And by focusing just on this geometry, we will be able to use everything we developed for waveguides to calculate the properties of such a resonant cavity, which you can use to store energy, electromagnetic energy inside. I'll actually even allow it to build up if you have some mechanism that keeps in putting energy into it. But there will also be cases where you might have a conducting sphere that also is a resonant cavity. And one example that I'll mention toward the end of this material is the Earth itself. You can regard as a resonant cavity, and there are resonances in the few hertz range that you can observe from the Earth resonating. So basically, before we had traveling waves like e to the ikz, now we're going to have to combine those with waves traveling in the opposite direction. And what we're going to get is we'll have standing waves in this waveguide. Those will be our resonant modes of the resonant cavity. And we're going to, first of all, start talking about this for perfectly conducting walls. So let's get into the math of these standing waves. So where we had psi of xy, where this obeyed the transverse two-dimensional Helmholtz equation, and then the z part, this will now go to psi of xy and either cosine kz or sine of kz. And so basically all the formulas, if you remember all these formulas on page 23 that you've all printed out, they have K in them. And all those formulas still work for this scenario, except you have to separately apply it to the e to the ikz and e to the minus ikz parts after breaking up the cosine into the two counterpropagating terms, and keep track of the fact that K in some of those formulas will sometimes be negative. So let's try to make this specialized because we're going to treat cylinders again, but of a constant with a constant cross-sectional area. And to be definite, I'm going to work out the details for the TM modes. The logic is very similar for TE, of course, but let's focus on the TM mode. And let's place the ends of our resonant cavity at Z equals 0 and Z is equal to D. Okay. This length D. For a TM mode, you'll recall psi, which we'll have to always find the solutions of the Helmholtz equation for, be the same as we had in the propagation down a waveguide. It'll be the same solutions we found there. But we have now one extra boundary conditions. We have the old boundary condition that EZ, the parallel component of Z is zero on the sides of the cavity of the waveguide. But now we have to add to that the boundary condition that E transverse components must be zero on the end caps, right, in order to make E parallel to be zero. Okay, you can visualize that, right? It's the, now on these parts, it's these parallel components of E transverse that have to vanish there. That's a new boundary condition we did not have before when we did our waveguide derivations. Okay, so this one is basically already solved. If we just grab the solutions that we had for TM modes in the waveguide, it takes a little more analysis, though, to figure out how to impose this boundary condition. So let's write it out. Remember our EZ, which we've said controls everything through the formulas on this sheet that had all the key equations of this chapter, right? I'm going to write Ez psi of xy now as cosine kz e to the minus I omega t. And break that up, of course, into exponentials and treat each term separately with opposite sign k. Now, I've picked cosine kz because it works, but let me convince you why we want cosine kz here. It's not so trivial to show this. So I'm going to start with equation 823a, in case you want to refer to Jackson, or you can find the equivalent in the notes, that sheet of all the formulas in the notes. There was this formula, the change of E transverse with respect to Z plus I mu omega z hat cross h transverse is equal to the transverse gradient of ez. And then another key equation we're going to use is equation 826b that says h transverse, we're going to need here, can be written as I over gamma squared times either plus or minus k for the two terms. Transverse gradient of hz, which is 0 for a TM mode. There is no HZ, plus epsilon omega Z hat cross transverse gradient of EZ. And I'm going to take Z hat cross this equation, which will basically add another term from the back cab rule that looks proportional to transverse gradient of EZ here, where Z hat cross HT is. I'll skip that algebra and jump to that equation with this assumed form for EZ. This gives DET DZ minus I mu omega I epsilon omega over gamma squared. Transverse gradient of EZ is equal to transverse gradient of EZ. Okay, right. So we have this transverse gradient of ET. I'm going to bring that to the other side and combine it so we get DET DZ is gamma squared minus mu epsilon omega squared all over gamma squared. This gamma squared over gamma squared is the one multiplying this del T. Right, times del T EZ. And if you remember, gamma squared minus mu epsilon omega squared, that is what we call minus k squared. So actually, I'll rewrite that as minus k squared over gamma squared transverse gradient of EZ. Okay, but now remember our goal. We're trying to make E transverse to be zero, and what we found is the derivative is this. We can integrate both sides of that equation to get E transverse. This step always makes me a little nervous to just take the indefinite integral of equations like that. But I think this is Jackson's logic. Probably should be more careful about justifying it, but the indefinite integral of that equation over z will be minus k squared gamma squares del t psi of xy. And now this integral of cosine becomes sine kz over k. So I suppose one should, to be careful, say that this would involve plus some constant in z, but I guess the constant we'll see would have to be zero to satisfy the boundary conditions. I guess that's the logic why that constant is just ignored, not even mentioned in the text. So from this is the reason we chose a cosine here, wherever that was, I guess here, instead of a sine, was because after going to ET to satisfy this boundary condition on the n-caps, now the sine function will vanish already at z equals 0, And to make it vanish at z equals d, we just need kd to be a multiple of pi, and we will satisfy that equation. And actually, I guess I'm calling p the integer here. So in other words, the k values allowed are p pi over d with p equals 0, 1, 2, and so on. And of course, the negative p values would not give you any new solutions. They would be proportional to the positive p values. And our fields then are E transverse for these TM mode inside our cavity minus P pi over D gamma squared sine of P pi Z over D. Transverse gradient of psi for the X and Y dependence, which were just the same solutions we found earlier in the chapter. And H transverse is I epsilon omega over gamma squared cosine of P pi Z over D, Z hat cross transverse gradient of psi. So these are the solution to the resonant modes in the cavity with p, this integer, 0, 1, 2, off to infinity. An infinite number of these oscillatory modes inside the cavity. Yeah? I think there's this 1 over k. I think it's right as written. But yeah, please do check my algebra. Here it's not always obvious whether the p equals 0 solution. You have to kind of think about it separately. But actually you see, even though E transverse would be 0 for a p equals 0 mode, the H transverse is non-zero. It's constant in Z, but that seems to be nothing to exclude it. So p equals 0 does seem to exist for a TM mode in the cavity. I'm not going to repeat the analysis for TE modes, but it'd be a good check to see whether you really understood the logic to go through it on your own. I will at least write the formulas for TE modes that you should be able to derive. E transverse works out to be minus I omega mu for gamma squared sine of p pi z over d z hat cross transverse gradient of psi, and h transverse is p pi over d gamma squared cosine of p pi z over d transverse gradient of psi. And in this case, the p equals 0 term you can see would be 0 for both of these, and so it's only the trivial solution with no physical relevance. So those are the TE solutions. And don't forget that gamma squared is mu epsilon omega squared minus p pi over d squared. So an interesting thing about a perfectly conducting resonant cavity is that it can only maintain oscillating electromagnetic fields inside at certain frequencies. Okay. So the eigenfrequencies of the resonant cavity of a perfect conductor we'll consider finite conductivity later, but if the conductivity is really infinite, then they are only discrete and they will have these values. They will depend on two indices, the eigenvalue index of the Helmholtz equation for the that you solve in the XY are characterized by lambda, and then the Z modes will be characterized by P, and it'll be one over mu epsilon gamma lambda squared plus P pi over D squared. So if you plot for a cavity, the energy stored or some observable like that versus frequency, you will see some delta functions. And only at those frequencies can you support a mode oscillating. There's an interesting implication about this, which is important in atomic physics. It's called the Purcell effect. So, any of you heard of that before? Ed Purcell, he was a Harvard professor who derived an effect. He was also happened to be a Purdue undergraduate. Has a degree from Purdue. The Purcell effect, he won the Nobel Prize, by the way. I don't think it was for this, but I'm not sure what it was for. Anyway, he did a lot with magnetic fields and such. But the Purcell effect is if you have your cavity and you put an atom in it, into an excited state, like 2p state of hydrogen, right? This wants to radiate photons of some particular wavelength, which is the energy difference divided by h bar. If that doesn't coincide, if that's this frequency, the atom can't radiate, because that mode does not even exist inside such a resonant cavity. So the Purcell effect is, and it applies to some extent, even if it's not a perfect conductor, then these get broadened into Lorentzians, as I'll show you in a minute. You won't get infinite lifetime of this state, but you'll get a longer lifetime, a suppression of the decay due to the cavity modes not lining up with the atomic transition frequency. Oh yeah, this was definitely a theoretical prediction. I'm pretty sure. It's a pretty hard experiment, really, to do this, to really control in the visible the cavity modes that accurately. Pretty sure it was first a prediction.
And would something like that just be used for what, like storage of an excited state, or?
Yeah, I'm not real sure what's the practical use of it. But certainly there are cases where you would like the energy stored in the atom to stay there longer. I can imagine. I'm not a very practical guy, so not very good at questions like that. I bet if you type that into the chat bot, he'll have some ideas for you. Yeah, probably. Maybe for an atomic clock, for instance, it could be useful there. Maybe a Rydberg state in a cavity. That sounds like Serge Haroche, who won a Nobel Prize for exploring ideas like that. Okay, so I was going to go through a concrete case of the right circular waveguide turned into a cavity. So now we specialize our cylinder to a right circular cylinder and put conducting end caps on it. So let's set up our geometry. We'll have a radius I've called capital R. And we'll still have the end caps at z equals 0, z equals d. At the moment, still, we're considering a perfect conductor. Okay, so we know psi obeys our Helmholtz equation in two dimensions. And of course, we'll set that up in circular polar coordinates. This is one of our favorite operators from last semester, 1 over rho d by d rho, rho d by d rho. It's 1 over rho squared d phi squared plus gamma squared psi of rho phi is 0. You already learned how to solve such an equation. Separable in these coordinates, the radial function times, you could do either the im phi, but let's do cosine or sine m phi, which are nice and real. And the rho solutions of this equation, if you plug this in and changes d squared d phi squared, becomes minus m squared. That differential equation in rho becomes solvable with a Bessel function, jm of gamma rho. And it has to be jm because this coordinate system includes rho equals 0. Only if you had like a coax cable, then you might need both Bessel solutions, regular and irregular solution. But here we just have one cylinder, rho equals 0 is in our domain. So only the jm of gamma rho obeys the boundary condition at rho equals 0. The Neumann Bessel function is irregular there. And now we impose the boundary conditions, and we have to specialize to either TM or TE. Again, I'll pick a TM mode to work out in more detail. For TM mode, we need psi on the surface to be 0. that means Jm of gamma capital R has to be 0. And so we use the roots of the Bessel function. We have only gammas determined by the roots of the Bessel function. So gamma has to equal the nth root of Jm of x equals 0, which you can find tabulated or you calculate in Mathematica. So then we have the sine or cosine solutions inside the resonant cavity that have these two indices, m and n, for either sine or cosine, which are Jm of xmn rho over r, and then multiplied by either sine m phi or cosine m phi. And the gamma mn squared that comes into the various formulas for the other field components will be xmn squared over r squared. And clearly it does have dimensions 1 over length squared, as we no, it has to. This is then also equal to mu epsilon omega squared minus our p pi over d squared. And so finally, the cavity eigenfrequencies, the only frequencies that support modes, electromagnetic monochromatic modes, are characterized by the three quantum numbers or indices, omega m n p will be 1 over root mu epsilon. Times x m n over r squared plus p pi over d squared all to the 1/2. Right. This, of course, is the speed of light in the medium inside the cavity. This is mu and epsilon for the material in the hollow part of the cavity. Often we're only interested in the lowest mode, so let's look at the explicit information we have about the very lowest TM mode. It has MNP equal to 0 for M, 1, the first root of the Bessel function is 1, and P equals 0 for the Z modes. And for that frequency, omega 0, 1, 0, B1 over root mu epsilon, X0, 1 over R, which is like 2.405 dot, dot, dot. If you look up the first root of the Bessel function, J0, the speed of light over the index of refraction inside the cavity, and then 1 over the radius. And then the actual fields inside, if you excite this mode, the energy is oscillating inside. There will be a Z component. There will be some amplitude that relates to how hard you drove it in the first place with some source or injecting into the cavity energy. You'll have J0 of X01 rho over R. And of course you have this time dependence, minus I omega 010 t. E transverse, as we found, is 0 since P is 0. But H transverse, function of rho phi and z, is minus I epsilon over mu to the 1/2 E0 J1 of X01 rho over R e to the minus I omega 010 t. If you remember, the z part for P equals 0 was just a constant. Okay, so that's an example where you can work out everything in complete detail for a perfectly conducting cavity. But let's get a little closer to reality and talk about how energy is dissipated. Some of this physics is all relevant, of course, to a laser cavity where you might have two mirrors and really no transverse confinement at all. So you might keep that in mind. When we're talking about modes in a cavity, we could also be thinking of a laser here, with the photons bouncing back and forth between the mirrors. Okay, so the next topic is energy dissipation in the cavity. And part of this will introduce the cavity. An important quantity for any resonant cavity is its Q value. Someone on the street comes up to you and says, I have a nice cavity, sir. Would you like to buy it? Or madam? The first question you'll ask is, well, I am in need of a cavity today. What is its Q value? What can you give me? So we can have losses from different things. We could have ohmic heating in the walls. In the walls of our resonant cavity. We could also have dissipation due to the dielectric media inside. All dielectric media have some non-zero imaginary part, which is associated with losses. Even though we often say it's real, but there will always be those losses we learned about when we talked about Cromer's Kronig. And like if it's a laser, what you sometimes need is like a half-silvered mirror or partially silvered mirror at the end so that the energy doesn't just bounce back and forth forever, but you allow some photons to come out of the laser cavity So you can use them for whatever you're going to use your laser photons for. So what do we expect? We expect our delta function response frequency modes, or if you like, you could call it the density of states inside the cavity, our sum of delta functions for a perfect conductor in frequency. This it's going to be modified, and these will acquire some width, these delta functions we derive for a perfect conductor. Okay, so how do we characterize cavity losses? We find a dimensionless parameter. And this is the one that has been chosen by the field. The Q parameter of the cavity is defined to be for each different resonant frequency. Each one will have a different Q value. It will be the frequency of that mode times the ratio of the stored energy over the power loss rate. And the name for this quantity is, it's dimensionless, of course. Quality factor of the resonant cavity. That's what Q stands for. You found that amusing. Q has lots of other meanings, right? I mean, in Star Trek, wasn't there like the Q guy who was really, really weird, kept showing up? And then wasn't Q also like a conspiracy theory or something? QAnon, Ralph, right. Okay, it's important, according to state law, to expose you all to many different political views. And now I've exposed you to that conspiracy theory. That's little Q. So, as you might guess where I'm going, I'm going to calculate Q. Because we can, and it's hard to have more fun than that. Okay, so let's derive it. So let's call capital U the quote time averaged energy inside our cavity. And what I mean by time averaged here is averaged over one period of the electromagnetic oscillations, like we've been talking before. But I have to be a little careful in saying that, because the energy inside is going to, of course, oscillate at the frequency of the electromagnetic oscillations, but it's also decaying. So the idea of an average over one period is assuming the decay is very slow compared to one period. Okay, so we'll just average over this one period, for instance, here, and then we can get a moving average, and we expect to see some sort of exponential decay, a smooth decay after you average over the fast oscillations. Okay, so again, one period means over delta t, which is 2 pi over omega naught. And then we will write the differential equation for the energy loss inside the cavity as a power, energy per second, as du dt is some constant zeta times u, which you can see from that equation, zeta has dimensions of a rate, inverse time, just like omega naught has units of inverse time. And so this zeta we can also write as the omega of the resonant frequency we are talking about divided by Q. And then Q, can turn that around as an equation for Q as minus omega naught U over du dt, the rate of energy, which should be negative, and as you're losing energy inside the cavity over time. Of course, this differential equation, if zeta is a constant, which we'll assume it is, can be solved, and we'll get a time dependence of the energy in the cavity. Then will look like U naught e to the minus omega naught t over Q. It will be the time dependence of the stored energy. Inside. And if the energy is decaying like this, that means the fields are decaying at half of that rate. Right. E to the minus omega naught, well, minus zeta t over 2, or omega naught t over 2q. So for instance, E of t inside will look like E naught, and then times e to the minus omega naught t over 2q, and then there will be an e to the minus I omega naught t, where omega naught is the frequency you would have for a perfect conductor. But there could be, when you make the walls finite conductivity, there could be a small shift in the real part of the frequency. It's typically only of order magnitude of the width of the line. So it's usually a very small number, and it's often ignored entirely in theory developments. So the losses can make not only decay exponential, which is their most important role, but it can also make a tiny shift in the actual resonant frequency. Now, you can Fourier analyze this to look at the frequency structure. Implied by this exponential decay. And you probably all remember that the Fourier transform of an exponential decay is a Lorentzian in frequency. Might as well go through that math. We have nothing better to do than that. So we'll start from E of t is 1 over root 2 pi integral over frequency of E of omega to the minus I omega t d omega, which can be inverted to give E of omega is E naught over root 2 pi integral minus infinity to infinity of E to the minus omega naught t over 2q E to the I omega minus omega naught minus delta omega t integral dt. It might be better to make that integral from 0 to infinity so I don't have exponential growth, but let me ignore that little detail and just say E of omega then is minus, it's an easy integral to do, E naught over root 2 pi. One over that exponent factor I times omega minus omega naught minus delta omega minus omega naught over 2q. And so the energy content, of course, will end up going like E of omega squared at each frequency omega will be absolute E naught squared over 2 pi and 1 over omega minus omega naught minus delta omega squared plus omega naught over 2q squared. That's our Lorentzian I promised was in the wings waiting to be displayed. We'll have a resonant omega on our E of omega squared plot versus omega. And now we'll have a nice Lorentzian line. This will have a gamma full width at half maximum, which is, you can read off omega over Q. Full width, half maximum. And actually, omega resonance, of course, is the omega naught plus the small shift, if you want to be careful. And typically, this delta omega, as I said in words a minute ago, over gamma, is typically less than or about unity, that tiny shift due to the losses in where the resonant frequency actually occurs. But if you're doing really careful atomic clock physics, you might need to think about that and keep track of that tiny frequency shift. Okay, so that's the math controlling how we describe the math of losses, but we haven't actually found a formula yet for the quality factor. And that is our mission. Next, how to actually calculate this for some resonant cavity. If you want to build an atomic clock, you're shooting for a quality factor with your atoms in an atom trap around 10 to the 11th. That's about the order of magnitude of the world record of quality factors in resonant cavities. If you have that, you can make an atomic clock nowadays that has about 10 to the minus 19 accuracy. That's an incredible development. Okay, but let's get back down to Earth, calculate Q. What we need to do that is make use of the fact that back in section 8.1, when we started this chapter, we found all the boundary conditions, how the fields just inside a conductor are controlled by the fields just outside. Because what we've derived are the fields just outside. Okay. And to find ohmic losses, we'll need the fields inside the conductor. So the fields just inside the conductor are determined. In fact, as we saw there, almost entirely by the values of H parallel just outside the surface. That ring a bell? You remember that? The graph I drew, fields falling off inside, but H parallel is really controlling those fields. You can write everything inside to a good approximation just in terms of H parallel outside. And those formulas in particular are H in the conducting material will be H parallel outside e to the minus xi over delta. Remember this xi, this normal to the surface coordinate going into the conductor. And delta is the skin depth. It wasn't only decaying, but it was oscillating as it decayed in the conductor and had this e to the ixc over delta as well. And e in the conductor then was also worked out back in section 8.1, mu c omega over twice conductivity sigma to the 1/2. There was a 1 minus I that tells you the phase of the electric field in the conductor. Then there was an n hat cross H parallel. Again, H parallel there is the H parallel outside. And then the exponential decay, xi over delta, and oscillation e to the I, xi over delta. We also derived the time average flow of energy into the surface per unit area. That was Jackson equation 8.12. The power loss per unit area was found to be mu of the conductor omega delta over 4. The magnitude of H parallel squared just outside, which could also be written 1 over 2 sigma delta H parallel squared just outside the conductor. Tells us the power going into the conductor, and be, which will show up as ohmic losses. So we've got ourselves a cavity, which is a waveguide, which has two different types of areas. We have the end cap area and we have the waveguide sides area. And we have to integrate the power loss over all of that. So the total rate of energy loss will be determined by this parallel components of the H field on every surface we're talking about in the system. We'll have the 1 over 2 sigma delta. We'll have the integral over the sides of the waveguide that are making the cavity we're talking only about resonant cavities of this shape now, be a different derivation for a spherical resonant cavity. Not going to do that one. Fun though that would be. This will be the area over integral, right? You can write as the dl integral over the round part circumference. And then an integral dz over the length of the waveguide cavity from 0 to d. And then we'll have the magnitude of n hat cross h squared on the sides. And then we'll have the n cap contribution. If the n caps are identical, we can just add a factor of 2 and just do the integral over 1 n cap, 2 sigma delta, integral over the area of the n cap, dA n hat cross h squared over the n, 1 n cap, where I've multiplied by 2, assuming the two n's are identical, or you can just do the two n's separate integrals. So we need the power loss and we need the energy stored inside to get our Q. Right, the power loss is that du dt. So the stored energy is U will be the integral over the cross-sectional area, integral over the length from 0 to d. And we're talking about time average, so we use our old formula for monochromatic waves, E dot d star plus B dot H star. And this has all been done before already, so let me just write down the integral as 0 to d dz integral dA over the area, either epsilon or mu, depending on whether we're talking about TM or TE modes. Then there are some factors, 1/2, 1 plus the squared wave number of the mode, k lambda p squared over gamma lambda squared, absolute size squared, and either we're integrating over cos squared p pi z over d or sine squared p pi z over d. This was derived back in equation 8.52, if you want to review your notes, if that's a little hazy in your recollection, where that equation got pulled out of. These integrals are all pretty straightforward, so I can write U is d over 4, epsilon or mu, again, for TM or TE. Now the z integral will give this 1 plus p pi over gamma lambda d squared. This will multiply the psi squared integral. Which we can't really do until we've specified the shape and everything. And then the z integral also has this kind of interesting factor, a Kronecker delta function of p comma 0. Do you see why we need that? The average value of the cosine, right, over which is a cosine that has wavelength multiple of d. Is a half, unless the p is 0, and then it's 1. So that's what this is accounting for. If p is 0, the average of cos squared is 1 over the cavity instead of a half. You all knew that. So now we can plug in some stuff that we had derived earlier for these different factors. If you remember, we introduced for TM, now I'm going to do TM only at this point, specialize the discussion to be a little more concrete. And the loss had this result, epsilon over sigma delta mu, 1 plus p pi over gamma lambda d squared. And then we had characterized, we had introduced a dimensionless constant of order unity that was called xi, not to be confused with xi, the coordinate going into the conductor. If you remember, we had this formula, 1 plus xi for the mode, xi lambda, circumference times d over 4 times the cross-sectional area of the waveguide. And then there's the 1 plus delta p comma 0 still there. And all of that multiplies the area integral for our mode psi. I should call it psi lambda. And this xi lambda, if you want to be reminded what it was 8.62 in the text. Area over circumference, 1 over mu epsilon omega lambda squared. The circumference integral of d psi dn squared dl over the area integral psi squared dA. So finally, we combine all these factors and get a formula for Q for TM modes as mu in the material over mu in the conductor making up the resonant cavity, d over delta, 1 plus delta p comma 0 over twice 1 plus xi lambda, circumference length over area times 4, 1 plus delta p comma 0. And another way to write it is a little simpler looking as mu over mu c times the volume over the total area of the surface area of the resonant cavity times the skin depth for that material making up the cavity, and then times a dimensionless geometrical factor, depends on the shape of the cavity, of order unity. So you see it's the skin depth, the area, the total area, of course, will be twice the area of one end cap plus the circumference of the waveguide times its length. It's the total surface area. And AD here would be the volume of the cavity. So I have just a little time left. I can at least give you an order of magnitude estimate. The sort of estimate they had to do in World War II when they were trying to make radar more efficient so they could sink German submarines. Let's take a copper cavity with a radius equal to its length of 10 centimeters, which is not too unusual. Take a frequency omega over 2 pi, which is 1 gigahertz. This has Q of about 2 × 10⁴. Actually, at the start of World War II, I was looking up some of the statistics. Cavities they had for microwaves, like for as in the early stages of radar, I think had Q pre-World War II, which was like in the range 200 to 1,000. And thanks especially to the British invention of the klystron, or magnetron, I guess they called it a magnetron, this was increased after to something like, I think, 5 × 10⁴. It was a huge jump that gave the good guys the good radar, and the bad guys only had the bad radar. Nowadays, you can make with a superconducting cavity Q of something like 10 to the 10, and some things like whispering gallery modes, and some of you might be working on whispering gallery modes, electromagnetic waves that are going around a ring like that. And I think there's some work in Chen-Lung Hung's group on those kind of geometries, and maybe also in Vlad Shalaev's, I'm not sure. You can maybe get up to 10 to the 11 or so. And I think 10 to the 11, if you look up Jun Yi's latest atomic clock physics papers, where he has now gotten up to 10 to the minus 19 relative accuracy of the atomic clock, whereas the ones in the sky that are in your giving you GPS, they're only about 10 to the minus 15 technology. I think those are cues maybe of the order of 5, 10 to the 11 from his laser cavity Q values. These atomic clocks, I just might mention parenthetically, if you take a 1 centimeter change in height, you can tell with this accuracy of atomic clocks now, you can tell that this clock at this height is a different frequency than a clock at that height, 1 centimeter. Amazing stuff. Okay. There is a photon interpretation of this Q value. I don't have time to do that today. I'll do that next time, and then we'll be on to chapter 9. If you came in late, yeah, don't forget my office hours on Friday are changed to 2:30. And today I'll be in my office from 11 to 12, but if you can hold your question till 11:30, I'd appreciate it. Exactly. It's all going around the outer circumference.